You're listening to The Rick Smith Show on the Progressive Voices Network.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. What a day it was. Kim Jong-un stood up at the altar, if you will. Then the breakup letter, the Dear Kim letter, the spy conspiracy, the big meetings. Just wow. I mean, what an action-packed day. And look, you know, you got to give, on a certain level, you got to give Trump credit for having the energy at 70, 71 years old to cause all of this chaos. I remember some of the old-timers at the nursing home that my mother used to work at. They'd cause a little mischief, and then they'd take a little nap. They had executive time an awful lot more, and they slept during their executive time instead of tweeting out and causing more trouble. Can we get him like that? Could someone, you know, just, you know, something? The big breakup. I guess it's a kind of a breakup. Maybe, you know, maybe not. Left the door open. They're spinning it as Donald was angry that the North Koreans called Pence a political dummy. A dunce, maybe. I would have gone with dunce. Almost kind of rhymes with Pence. A little bit closer. Dunce, closer than dummy. Because I don't think he's a dummy. I think he's a dunce. So there's a difference. I don't buy that Trump cared about that at all. Had someone called Trump a dummy and said he was a political dummy, then yes, I would completely buy it. I think that what happened was is they realized that they were going to look like complete and total fools when nothing got done at a meeting. And this is under the hashtag of not just anyone can be president. And I've been saying this for a while. Great. You know, the talks are going forward. It's something we should be doing. We should be trying to pull the North Koreans into the international community, you know, open up that, you know, open the market, you know, get them, you know, getting some of our stuff, you know, feeding them a little bit, all of that. And, you know, try to educate them and move them into the 19th century at least. And, I don't think the White House, I don't think Trump thought it through. My fear has always been, and this is on every issue. It's on trade. It's on foreign policy. It's on, you know, just setting up an Easter egg hunt on the North Lawn. There are things that have to be done beforehand. There is a protocol. There's a way to go through things. There are preconditions that have to be met. There are meetings. There are scripts. There's all of this. And the formal meetings between the two heads of state is basically just political theater. And I don't know if most people get this. And it's one of those things that, you know, when people were saying, well, you know, I like Donald Trump because he's unpredictable. Well, this is what unpredictable gets you. It gets you a lot of high hopes. And then you get the collapse. And then you end up making situations worse. Because you know John Bolton's in the background just giddy, going, oh boy, we're going to go to war. Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, I get to blow off things. And you just go, at some point, please, some sanity in there. So no big date on June 12th. That's not going to happen. Or maybe it is. You know, you don't know. Maybe tomorrow he comes out with a tweet and says, back on. And then there's the conspiracy of there was a spy in his campaign. There's a huge difference of putting it in this. And I think James Clapper made this very clear. There's a huge difference between having someone in a campaign who is looking into your campaign or someone who's looking into Russian interference. And that's evidently what this informant, wasn't a spy, he was an informant. This is what this informant did, because as I understand it, this is someone that Peter Navarro brought in. So Trump's own guy brought him into this. But that doesn't seem to matter because it doesn't fit the narrative of crooked Hillary and, you know, evil Obama. They just wanted to bring him down. And they're going to spy on him and they're going to do all this crooked stuff. Didn't happen that way. But it'll be interesting to see how this plays out in that I'm all in favor of more investigations. I want to know what this guy was looking into. I want to know what he was telling the FBI. I think this is good stuff if you're someone who believes in transparency. Now, the big meeting today, there was a big meeting, the intelligence people and some members of Congress and even some people from the White House. And you go, what's Emmett Flood doing? What's the president's lawyer doing at this big powwow? What's John Kelly doing at the big powwow? Why are they there? This is classified information into investigating them. It would be like if, you know, you were charged with, you know, whatever. You were going to be charged possibly with something and you wanted to get a look at all of the evidence that they might have before they charge you. Because no, once you're charged, you then get to see all the stuff. But in the investigation, it'd be like you being able to be right there following the investigation. So that every piece of information that they come up with, you can then discredit. And this is why Flood was there. It's a two-prong thing. He was there for two reasons. One, wanted to get information. And two, a heavy-handed tactic. This is a very authoritarian kind of tactic. We're watching you. We know who you are. We know what you know. Better not step out of line. We know. And it's one of those things where, you know, it's kind of creepy. And, you know, even Giuliani went and said that that Flood and Kelly went to the briefing because they wanted to find out as much as they could. He says, if we learn a good deal from it, it will shorten the whole process considerably. Yeah, because whatever they can find out, they'll be able to muddy the waters over the next couple of weeks over and desensitize and destroy whatever information they can, and thus trying to shorten the investigation. Now, evidently, you know, Giuliani claims that he thinks, you know, Trump wanted him there, doesn't know that Trump wanted him there, but assumed that Trump wanted him there, which means Trump wanted him there. Now, you look at this and you keep coming back to this idea that, because here's how Sarah Sanders sold it. Yeah, John Kelly, the White House chief of staff, was there. Yeah, the White House's lawyer was there. Yeah, but they only stayed for a couple minutes. They only, you know, said a couple of words, and then they left before the meeting started. And you go, you know, that's one of those, like I said, it's one of those authoritarian things where you just go, that's a little heavy-handed. It's a little much for me. But I guess not surprising. So lots of this insanity, and I want to know what was in this meeting as well. I want to know what this informant said. I want to know what they were looking into, and I want to know what they found. You know, the fact that they had informants in the campaign as early as July, you got to go, somebody was paying attention to something, and I think we should know what it is. It's that simple. Anyway, I'd love to hear your thoughts. What do you think? Was it just an innocent showing up, wanting to wish them luck in their investigation and say, look, you know, we're with you. We're going to give you all the information you need. We're here for you. Or was it, we know who you are. We know where you live. We know what schools your children go to. Yeah. Fun. Lots of stuff to get to today. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Chuck Collins is going to be here to talk about his new book, Income Inequality in This Country Irreversible? Is it something that it's too late? We're too far down the path. Nowhere to go from here. He's going to share some of his thoughts and his new book. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
90% of the wealth. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1959. That was the day Operation Humanity marched in support of New York City hospital workers fighting for union recognition and bargaining rights at area voluntary hospitals. Workers organizing with Local 1199 had been on strike since May 8th and called on the public to support them in their efforts. They pointed out that the 30,000 overwhelmingly black and Latino workers were fighting against economic exploitation and discrimination. Striking workers condemned their paltry wages, which averaged $21 less a week than workers at city hospitals. They added they had no job security or benefits and were not even eligible for unemployment. The Central Labor Council, the NAACP, and area civil rights activists all supported the march. In their book, Upheaval in the Quiet Zone, Leon Fink and Brian Greenberg note that a union largely led by Jews had squared off against hospitals directed by the Scion of the city's Jewish community, to the degree that it was a family affair. The 1959 fight thus took on the bitterness of a civil war. As well, Catholic trade union leaders decried the anti-union fervor of hospitals run by the Archdiocese. Fink and Greenberg illustrate the support of fiery Mike Quill, president of TWU Local 100, who denounced hospital trustees as worse than famed segregationist Governor Orville Faubus of Arkansas. Weeks into the strike, area trade unions supplied reinforcements in the form of donations, loans, and groceries. Local IBEW members assessed themselves $1 a week for the strikers. Many unions regularly joined picket lines in support. Though the strike would fail to secure union recognition and collective bargaining rights, there were minimal gains. Solidarity galvanized the membership for future battles. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed, with your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy, through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So, you know, all the time we're looking at these numbers where CEO pay is just off the charts, and yet you've got millions of families in this country who can't make it on a 40-hour work week. Millions of families living below the poverty line and, you know, working. I mean, this is the thing that gets me. And I know the Goldwater Institute loves to say there are no poor people who work 40 hours, Rick, because we give them all these wonderful things like heating assistance and school lunch and earned income tax credits and all of that. But I say, look, most working people, they don't want handouts. They want to make a living. They want to support themselves and they want to move forward without all of that. And you look at the alligator jaws that I remember learning about in economics class, and they're widening between the haves and the have-nots, and at some point, it's got to snap back, or can it? Which is why I've asked Chuck Collins to come talk with us. He's a senior scholar at the Institute for Public Policy. Got a new book out titled, Is Inequality in America Irreversible? I sure hope so. Chuck, thanks for taking time for us.
Great to be with you, Rick. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, you look at this and it just seems to keep growing. But the Goldwater Institute says, Chuck, that there's no such thing as people who work in poverty. You buy that?
Well, yeah, I mean, here's what we know. We're living through, we're into the fifth decade of wage stagnation. Most of the income growth has gone to the top one-tenth of 1%. And half the population hasn't seen their real paychecks go up since Jimmy Carter was president. So, I don't know what research they're looking at or what they're smoking.
And that's It's a good way to put it, what they're smoking, because at the end of it, it's got to be something, and maybe they should share. But, you know, you look at this, and you know, a lot of people are saying, Chuck, you know, why does this matter? You know, if you raise the minimum wage workers' paychecks, if the fast food workers get $15 an hour, I'll never be able to buy a hamburger, so heck with them.
We've been hearing that for, you know, the last several decades, and what we've what the real, you know, there's now a lot of evidence that shows you raise the minimum wage, there is a huge economic benefit to that. Actually, working people spend their money in the local economy. Low wage workers who get a boost, you know, spend their money on things that people touch and feel and eat. It has a positive economic effect. That it doesn't. The sky does not fall, which is kind of what you keep hearing, that somehow it's going to hurt the economy to raise the floor. You know, we've been living through, you know, you started off talking about CEO pay. We have an interesting thing, Rick, which was as part of the Dodd-Frank financial reform, companies now have to disclose what's the ratio between their CEO pay and their average or median worker pay. And we're just starting to see these reports coming in, and they're pretty astonishing. And the most astonishing is the toy maker Mattel.
Yes.
Whose CEO was paid 4,900 times more than their median worker. So just as an example. So we're very excited to get more and more of that data as it comes in. We know that, you know, the average Fortune 500 company now probably has a 300 to 400 ratio between CEO and average worker pay.
Yeah, but do you think that's going to matter, Chuck? Do you think that really is going to matter? I mean, I think we already know that you know, CEO pay is way out of whack. I think the average worker gets it. I hope you're right. I hope, you know, the transparency part of it, you know, every year something puts out a story and says, look how much it's worse it's getting. But, you know, I, as a working guy, I can go, you know what, the guy I work for, you know, he makes 350 times what I make. What power do I have to change that?
Well, one thing that I think this will lead to is more laws or rules that say things like, hey, if you're a public contractor, if you're going to do business with the government, for instance, or the military, you shouldn't have a ratio that exceeds X times. And we're starting to see that. A number of cities are saying, corporations that have a ratio that is excessive of 100 to 1 have higher tax rate. They're just recognizing that as a society, higher costs when workers aren't paid enough.
I'm with you.
Pick up the slack.
No, I'd love
pick
to see that.
Slack. So yeah, it's not just about the transparency and the information. It's now we have a source across the board where we can compare all these companies, and we can start to legislate policies that reward companies that lift their floor and pay their workers a decent wage.
And I would argue it actually has to happen again. And you know, maybe we're going to get to this. Maybe, you know, I just this week you saw the Supreme Court come out with the Epic Systems case, which is going to, you know, make mandatory forced overtime. I mean, mandatory forced arbitration clauses mandatory for every working person in the country. We know Janus versus AFSCME is coming very soon. You know, I'm hoping that at some point all of these attacks on labor, all of these stabs in the back, wake the working class of this country up and we become a little bit more militant and start demanding better wages, hours, and conditions, and start getting, you know, pushing for politicians to push laws to maybe get us back to somewhere near the original National Labor Relations Act.
No, I think you're right. I think we kind of hit in bottom, hopefully. And you could see this with teachers in states where they've been, you know, squeezing and doing the kind of austerity, there's not enough money thing, and eliminating taxes on corporations and the rich. And we're starting to see the pushback there. And I think, you know, that these inequalities can only go so far before, you know, there's, I think, a big pushback. That's my hope. I actually think it's possible. I think, you know, there is a realignment happening. As much as we are distracted by things at the national level, people think the rich should pay more taxes. They think the minimum wage should be much higher. They think teachers should be better paid. They think we should be investing in public infrastructure and things that actually, you know, create opportunity. They think it's ridiculous that students have so much debt. All these things are popular, wildly popular positions, and a reflection that too much inequality has basically pushed a lot of people to the brink.
I think there's going to be
a pushback.
Yeah, I've said for a very, very long time, you know, nothing changes in this country until the 1% fear that their heads could be on pitchforks. And I know that sounds a bit militant, but, you know, that's really what it is. And I'm not saying, you know, literally on pitchforks, or maybe I am. But, you know, what I'm saying is that, you know, there's no fear of the working class right now because there are no mechanisms there yet, in my view, for the masses to demand more. Our political system is so badly broken right now. We're so badly polarized on every other issue besides your paycheck that I just don't know that's going to happen anytime soon. And I fear things get much worse before they get any better.
Yeah, no, I kind of share that. Although it's interesting, I was sort of like here in Massachusetts where I'm sitting, you know, we have three ballot initiatives going forward, one for paid family medical leave, one to raise a minimum wage to $15, and another to tax millionaire incomes a little bit higher to invest in education and transportation. Well, those are all polling wildly popular. California, there are a number of states that I think will start to show, not only will there be hopefully a political electoral tide, but on some of these issues, we're going to see these economic populist themes, progressive populist themes winning and helping people win elections. And that's going to be the beginning of a shift, I think.
No, I hope you're right. And you talk about it in your book, because we need these transformative campaigns. We need, you know, to be fighting for higher wages. We need to be fighting for public transit, for debt-free education, for health care. You know, soon, to, you know, one of the things you also talk about, the idea of a guaranteed minimum income to make sure that as automation takes jobs from humans, that there's a way for people to be able to exist. All this stuff, things that we have to be talking about and pushing for. But what do you say to the person who goes, you know what, you know, that's just how the economy works. You got winners, you got losers, and you know what, you know, shame on the losers.
Well, I would say there's two things we should look at. One is after the period after World War II, when the rising tide did lift almost all the boats, and where there was a blossoming of a U.S. middle class. And how did that happen? It's because we taxed high incomes, we taxed wealth, we invested in public goods, we invested in people in terms of education, both vocational training and higher education. We invested in helping people get on the wealth building train. You know, I had an uncle who bought his house on a farmer's home loan after World War II. I bought a farm for, you know, 30-year, 1% fixed rate loan, you know. Well, that didn't just come out of nowhere. So we actually know something about how to build a shared prosperity economy, and there are people still who have a memory of what that looked like. And then we can look north of the border, and other countries have much less inequality, and they actually have greater social mobility. You know, this whole idea of the American dream, it moved to Canada about 10 years ago. If you're not born rich, you're better off living in Canada, where at least they invest in, you know, universal health care, access to education. You don't go to college and go into debt for the next decade. All those things. Those are societies. We can do much better. It doesn't have to be this way.
No, I'm with you, but I would disagree with you that mobility moved to Canada. I think it was ICE that came in the middle of the night and kidnapped it and then kicked it out of the country.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, deported. We deported the American dream.
Yeah, I mean, it's more like that to me than it was that it just moved, because it wasn't like we had a choice in it. It just happened, and it comes back to the people that we elect. And I keep coming back to this. It's the politics of it. And I know a lot of people say, "Oh, I don't like politics. I don't want to be involved in it." It is what has created this environment in which we're in, where the rich keep getting richer and the poor, well, they keep getting poorer. And I always come back to something my grandfather said. He always said if a rich guy's going to take a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it, because he understands return on investment. He wouldn't be spending the money if he wasn't going to make more off of it. And that just seemed to be a simple common truth back for him, and I would argue today.
Boy, it's funny when you say that, because it made me think of, why are the Koch brothers spending $10 millions to convince you that this tax cut is a good idea? You know, that's a great example of like that should, and it's fascinating how, I mean, I think it's great that most people didn't fall for it. The trickle down, you know, idea that somehow we're going to cut taxes on these corporations and the rich, and that's going to be good for most people. It never really caught stride. Most people didn't fall for it, even though they had the power to ram the tax cut through in December. Even today, I mean, it's more and more people are like, whoa, this isn't really going to help me, and it's really going to, you know, be a windfall for the rich, and it's ultimately going to lead to cuts and things that I care about.
Yeah,
well, I think the good news is people aren't falling for it.
No, I'm with you, and I hope people will wake up even more, and I hope they check out your book. It's titled, Is Inequality in America Irreversible?, written by Chuck Collins. But, you know, here's the thing. You know, for me, I've said this kind of... And you go into this in the book a little bit about why this is bad for... Let me ask you, why is it bad for democracy?
Well, concentrated wealth in the hands of a few is bad. You know, it's concentrated power, the power to shape the rules. I mean, we have, you know, one billionaire, Sheldon Adelson, who's, you know, dictating foreign policy in Iran and, you know, putting forward, you know, backing regressive candidates. So... Again, as people are listening, we should be mad that we're being disenfranchised, that the big money is taking away whatever voice or power we have over our political system. It's like, you know, so it's undermining everything we care about, including our voices in our governance.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable to me. I mean, and the more I look at this and the more we continue to grow apart, I grew up, you know, in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, and I, you know, because of my union and because of hard work, I've moved into, you know, somewhat of a comfortable area. My fear is that path doesn't exist for the next kid like me. It doesn't exist for the next generation. And we end up becoming, like John Edwards talked about in 2004, that two Americas.
Yeah, no, I think we're very concerned for the next generation that, you know, whatever kind of ladder opportunity was built is being dismantled, and we are becoming much more polarized. And, you know, what's interesting is when I talk to business groups, I actually say, look, this is bad for you, business. You know, you don't want to have a hollowing out of the middle class. You need to have aggregate demand. You can't have consumption just based on people borrowing on their credit cards. That's what got us into trouble in 2008. You know, you should be it's in your interest to invest in workers. It's interesting to see there is a segment, not all of them, but there's a segment of employers who would like to take a high road, but they're constantly having to compete against the low road companies. And again, that's where it's important to have organized workers who can help lift the floor and lift standards so we can have a higher road economy. But boy, you know, that dynamic just keeps playing out.
Yeah, it's amazing to me. And the more I look at it, the more we really have to do something about it. So, you know, what do you know, so I can give some people, I can give folks marching orders, ideas. What's the first step in fighting back against this? And then long term, what's the big idea that you think, if there's one thing you could pick that would help close this gap, what would it be?
Well, I think it still is that formula of what are things that we can do together to create a foundation. So we want to raise the floor. We want to have a higher minimum wage. We want to expand universal health insurance. We want to have, like the Nordic countries and Canada, a floor which you cannot fall through, and that less people, no one should be living in fear that they're going to become destitute because they lost their job, they got a health emergency, got divorced. You know, they shouldn't be worrying about their parents' long-term health care. We, you know, underestimate how each of us individually are holding stress and fear because of that. And it just doesn't have to be that way. So I think, but I think we should also look at how do you reduce that concentration of wealth at the top. You know, so in California, students are organizing to restore the state inheritance tax, the tax that's only paid by multimillionaires and billionaires when they pass on,
right,
and dedicate that $4 billion a year to free higher education. In a number of cities, we're seeing all these luxury high-rise buildings being built. These are like global repositories of billionaire wealth. We're kind of helping create wealth storage units for the global rich. Well, we should be taxing high-end real estate at much higher levels. We should tax high-end real estate transfers. This is less of an issue maybe in the heartland, but it's a big issue on the coast. And put that money into decent, affordable housing. So I make the point that we should be looking at campaigns that link things that reduce inequality to generate revenue for things that expand a better life for everybody. And that come with a constituency. So in California, we have students willing to fight. In cities, we have people who are trying to find decent, affordable housing willing to fight to tax that high-end real estate. So I think those are the kind of some of the pathways forward.
Yeah, I would like to, you know, dig up Dwight David Eisenhower and go back to his tax code. Give me the good socialist president Eisenhower's tax code. We'll go back there. Also, I would like to see corporate money out of politics.
Absolutely. I mean, we should, you know, we have to protect our democracy at this point. The political gerrymandering, the influence of money on campaigns, and all the dark money that Jane Mayer and other people talk about that are flooding in behind the scenes, the fact that the Koch brothers spend all this money lobbying to lie to us about these tax cuts, you know, that's where we have to cut the faucet off of corporate money.
Got to cut off the welfare.
Corporations can't directly, supposedly, give to candidates, but they find all kind of ways around that, close off those roots.
Well, corporations aren't people, my friend. At least that's what Mitt Romney told me. Sad, sad stuff. I hope people will take a look at the book, Is Inequality in America Irreversible?, written by Chuck Collins. He's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies. We'll get a link out on how you can maybe pick up the book. And real short read, 119 pages, blow through it in about an hour and a half or so. Good stuff, good information. Chuck, as always, great having you on the program. I appreciate you taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick, for having me.
Good stuff. Good stuff indeed. Again, you know, he not only that book, get the other one too, called Born on Third Base. Fantastic stuff. Important stuff. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1949. That was the day that a shotgun blast broke through a closed window and struck Victor Reuther as he sat reading a newspaper in his living room. Victor, along with his brothers Walter and Roy, were leaders of the United Auto Workers Union, one of the most powerful forces of the 20th century U.S. labor movement. During the 1930s, the three brothers moved to Detroit and became involved in the hard-fought efforts to bring unions to the Motor City. Victor got a job at the Kesley Hayes Wheel Company. He joined UAW Local 174. During the Flint sit-down strike against General Motors, Victor gave speeches to help rally the strikers. According to Mike Smith of Wayne State University, Victor, quote, had this deep, resonating voice. He coupled that with a superb control of the language. And when he got up to give a speech, it was usually a beauty. Victor would go on to become the UAW's education director and international director. Roy took up the role of legislative director. Walter became the union's president. Their union leadership made many enemies for the three Reuther brothers. Walter was the victim of a gunshot attack in 1948 that permanently injured one of his arms. The next year, an unknown would-be assassin took aim at Victor. The blast hit Victor in the face. He lost his right eye, and the bullet smashed his jaw and collarbone. In his memoir, Victor wrote that he told the surgeon, quote, "They can take out my eye and take of an arm or a leg, but please fix up my tongue. I've got a living to make." Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
I was standing by gate 4 when I heard the people roar. They ain't gonna kick the auto workers around. It's that UAW-CIO.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
It was an inside job by the well connected. Your little protest.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. So some craziness going on in Ohio. You go, what's wrong with my former state? What's going on? Well, it's what happens when you have, you know, dictatorial rule. Evidently, the FBI searched the former Speaker of the House's home, raided the house there. And it's going to be interesting to find out how this plays out. And here to share some thoughts on the insanity. I guess there were some more raids going on. We've got Brett Pransky on the line. He's running for State House there in Ohio's 77th District. Brett, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So am I getting this right? There was the big raid. What's going on?
Well, a while back, there were rumors of an FBI investigation. The Speaker of the House ended up stepping down. It seemed to be kind of a preemptive move before what ended up happening in the past couple days happened. What happened yesterday was the FBI raided his home and a storage unit that he owned, or that he was renting at least. And on top of that, today, apparently they went downtown to the Reif building where a lot of these folks hold offices, and they collected some material there as well. But I don't really know much about that yet, what they took or who they took it from. But apparently the story is that he removed a bunch of stuff from there, something like 60 boxes full of documents and things like that. And that's what was in that storage unit that just got raided.
Okay. So the shredders weren't working overtime then.
Yeah, apparently not. So, and you know, that's the kind of thing that anyone in office should know is a no-no anyway. All that stuff belongs to the Ohio Historical Society. You're not allowed to take it out of there and store it, you know, in your own space. Right. Right. So, and all of this basically comes from a scandal that hasn't fully been fleshed out yet, but apparently what had happened was there was a bill, a bipartisan bill, to cut the interest rates for payday lenders. And payday lenders are pretty much predators, and they have higher interest rates in Ohio, I believe, than any other state in the country. So there was a bipartisan bill to kind of bring this under control and bring those interest rates down. And the bill just got magically held up in committee. The 17-page bill was held up for 58 weeks. So that's reading at a rate of about a third of a page per week, right? So the bill is held up in committee, and apparently while it's held up in committee, the lobbyists and payday lending folks are doing everything they can to kill or weaken the bill. And apparently there's a lot of pay-to-play going on where they were buying things for legislators and so on. To what extent, we don't know. We do know they paid for an all-expense-paid trip to Europe for the speaker, and I'm pretty sure he didn't go on that trip alone. So, and I think that's kind of where this is all stemming from, but we don't know exactly what the details are, but we do know that it's some pretty serious stuff that's likely to turn criminal here in the near future.
And well, let's hope so. I mean, I'm a supporter of perp walk parades. I'm sure that you know, one of the prisons there in Ohio, I'm sure they would be happy to build an additional wing for our political class, because at the end of the day, I'm a good governance guy, and if you screw it up, the hammer should come down, and you should be a guest of the state at the Gray Bar Hotel, in my view.
Yeah, and you know, depending on, and of course, we have to let the facts play out and find out exactly what happened. But it certainly looks to be heading in that direction.
Now, you guys have had a lot of scandal. I mean, you're almost going to catch up to Pennsylvania if you keep this up.
Yeah, because that's not the only thing that's kind of currently out there and really upsetting people. There's another scandal had to do with the charter school ECOT. Now, this scandal was a little different. It had to do with kind of defrauding the taxpayers. Basically, ECOT was an online school,
Right. So, cyber charters, love those. All failing. Here in Pennsylvania, we got 16 of them. They're all failing. And it could, you know, it could explain why they're only only reading a third of a page a week, though.
Yeah, probably could explain that. But here in Ohio, what they were doing was, you know, in these situations where you're paid per student and you're paid per student who's attending, there's a lot of incentive to cook the books. And that's exactly what happened. So there were they were claiming students who weren't actually attending in pretty significant numbers. So what was happening was they were billing the state for all kinds of money that they hadn't actually earned. And the total bill from my last count is somewhere upwards of $80 million that they've stolen from the taxpayer and stolen from my local public schools and from my children's future and so on and so forth. So it's something that's really got people fired up and angry about, not to mention on top of that, because I don't want to leave these folks out. When they finally got caught and had to close up shop, they dumped 12,000 students. I mean, just immediately. They just closed their doors and those students didn't have anywhere to go. So they, you know, they fed those students back into the schools that they were failing at in the first place. And that's, you know, that's another part of the scandal that's just absolutely tragic for Ohio.
Right. Without the money, though. I mean, this is the other part. This is the part that infuriates me when these charter schools go down. And when they go, you know what, we took all the money, time to go, the kids go back to the public school, who then has to remediate and spend a ton of money to catch them up while getting no additional revenue to do that, because all of that money, at least in Pennsylvania, I don't know how it is in Ohio, all of that money went with them at the beginning of the year. So all gone, but the public school still got to be there as the safety net for these failed charters.
Yeah, and that's the case here, too. I do believe they've had some success recovering the money. But when I say some, I mean a very small sum. Most of that money has just simply vanished.
Not vanished. It was stolen. Thievery.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Look, and I've been saying for a while, you know, you've got Donald Trump in the White House, a kleptocrat. You've got, it looks like, an entire General Assembly, your legislature, a bunch of kleptocrats. At some point, the voters have got to be looking at your elected folks. They're going, it's time to throw the bums out.
Yeah, and that's exactly the case, because what we have here in Ohio is we have supermajorities in both houses. So there's 99 members of the Ohio House. I believe 66 seats are held by Republicans. There are 33 seats in the Senate. I believe 24 are held by Republicans. I believe that math is correct. And that's what happens when you have a supermajority like that. What you get is a bunch of legislators who start to feel invincible, start to feel like they can't be touched, like they can do literally whatever they want. And then they do. And it leads to what we're seeing now.
Yeah. And there's nobody on the other side to hold them accountable. I mean, that's the other part of this. They start doing everything in back rooms. At least that's how they do it here in Pennsylvania. When they want to you know, do some you know, behind the scenes stuff, close the door. Democrats, they shouldn't even bother showing up. Because that's how few we've got right now. And I'm hoping that with all of this corruption and all of this bad governance, that people turn around and go, you know what? These people who told us that they don't believe in government and government can't work, they've shown us they can't run government. They should all go.
Right. Right. And that's something that I, you know, it's one of the reasons I got into the race was some of these issues that, you know, that we're dealing with now. And, you know, every voter I speak to is upset. You know, it doesn't matter who they traditionally vote for. Doesn't matter if they're hardcore Republicans or hardcore Democrats. They're upset with the way things are going, and they're embarrassed by kind of what our legislators are painting us as, you know, for the rest of the nation. So, you know, hopefully there's going to be a remedy for it in November. You know, I plan on putting up one heck of a race. You know, and talking to everybody in the district and knocking on every door that there is to knock on, and try to do it two or three times before November comes. And because that's what we have to do.
Right.
We don't have the dirty money. You know, we don't, you know, I can't call up, you know, 19 corporate PACs and have them fund my campaign. I said at the outset, I'm not taking any of that money. I wouldn't take it if they offered it to me. So we have to outwork them. And that's what we're in the process of doing. We are contesting every district in the state of Ohio. There is a candidate in all 99 House districts. That hasn't happened in quite a while. So we're putting up the good fight. We're putting it up everywhere. And I guarantee you, you know, when November comes, it's going to be real interesting what happens here in Ohio.
No, I mean, this is one of the things I give Donald Trump a lot of credit for. And he didn't mean to do it. Trust me. He has awakened a bunch of working people who are saying, you know what, we've got to take back our government. And here in Pennsylvania, it's the same thing. I have never seen so many good, honest, decent, qualified people step into the public arena and say, hey, I'm going to run. I mean, I look at you, for instance. You've got to be taking a pay cut if you win this job. But you're doing it for I think, the right reasons.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, if in terms of my own ambitions and where I saw my career going and, you know, where I saw myself, you know, 5 years ago, where I would be today, you know, running for a political office would have not been anywhere, you know, in my guesses at that time. This is a kind of thing that wasn't even on my windshield, you know, 8 months ago, you know, but it just seemed like the thing to do. When you, and it's one thing that, you know, there are a lot of teachers who are running. I'm a teacher by day. And, you know, teachers are servants at heart. You know, what we want to do is we want to serve our community. We want to do the very best for the people around us. And every now and then an opportunity comes up to do that at a little higher level. And so, you know, when I saw that opportunity and I started talking with, you know, with a few Democratic leaders about the potential for doing this, all of a sudden something that I would have never thought would be on my radar, you know, a year ago or 2 years ago, now all of a sudden I'm the candidate. So it's moving pretty fast, but I have to say that I'm pretty proud of the way things have gone so far.
Good on you. Again, you come back to this. You know, how deep do you think this scandal could end up going? I mean, does this rise to the governor? I mean, where do you think this goes?
I don't have any evidence at this point that it rises beyond the legislature, but I think it's fairly safe to say that the speaker isn't the only one who's going to go down. You know, most of these things that are really being looked at and scrutinized are things and events where there are multiple people in the room. So, you know, who and how much and where this goes and who's holding a subpoena right now, I really can't say it. I can guarantee you nobody down there is talking.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it comes back to this is why you need to have the checks and balances. You go back to the founding of the country. They wanted transparency, they wanted accountability, but they also wanted checks and balances. They didn't want extreme power on any side. And this is what happens when, you know, when the corporate money, I believe this, you don't have to come along, but when the corporate money decides they own one party, this is what you get, just tons of money, tons of infrastructure. It's incredible what the right wing has built in this country. And really, you know, give them credit. They've masterfully manipulated our government.
Well, yeah, it's actually real interesting how they and how they've gone about it, too, because their original plan was to start in state legislatures like the seat I'm running for. So, for example, if I wanted to donate to a congressman or a federal seat, I'm capped out at about, I think it's $2,700, you know, is the max that you can donate to a candidate. But in a race like mine, you can donate almost $13,000 to a candidate. And not only that, but to donate to a congressman, I have to be 18 years old. To give to a state legislature candidate, you only have to be 7. So there are, you know, big risks.
Whoa, stop. How many 7-year-olds are giving their paper route money up to?
Well, on. I guarantee there are going to be several before this cycle is over, because that's what they do. They cut $12,000 checks in their name and the name of everyone in the family, and including children on down to 7 years old. That's how they feed the money into the system. And so what you get is, you know, at the federal level, you get a lot of corporate money in the system, but the ratios between the haves and have-nots aren't too terribly severe. You get down to the state legislature. The last guy who ran for the seat I'm running for now got outspent 25-1.
Wow.
That's what the ratios get to be like. So these are the seats they're trying to buy. All right. Because what they can do at the next level is they can just redraw the lines.
Right.
So by the legislature, redraw the lines, and then just, you know, just draw lines that get your opponents out of the races. So, you know, they're getting their money in where they think it will do the most good for them.
Nice.
And it's created a pretty rigged system.
It's amazing to me. But, hey, look, you got to give them credit. I mean, you know, we hear a lot about the American Legislative Exchange Council. And as you pointed out, you know, they've drilled down to the you know, county, to the borough level. They've got this other organization, the American City County Exchange. It's ALEC for your neighborhood, if you will. And they do the exact same kind of things. You know, it's you know, funneling money in from the billionaires. It's model legislation. It's pushing an agenda that, you know, they're just using politicians as as puppets. And the whole idea of having a local politician is that they're supposed to know what your needs are. They're supposed to be serving their constituents. And I look at a lot of these Republicans and you go, how can you justify the healthcare votes that you took? How can you justify that tax scheme on the federal level? How can you justify these cyber charters that nobody thinks works? And it doesn't matter because the money is just flooding this whole system.
That's absolutely right. I mean, for example, you know, groups like ALEC, they write legislation. So what you get is from state to state, you get bills that look strikingly like each other.
Yep.
So and most of the time, because they're handing out to you know, to some bought and paid for representative like a Mad Lib. Just fill your name in here, fill your name in there. Walk it out onto the House floor and introduce it, and then everyone will vote for it. And next thing you know, we have a new law. Yeah. So it's almost that simple.
It is that simple. And you know what's really funny to me, to be honest, is that there was a woman down in Florida who didn't even fill in the Mad Lib. She just left Alec's name right on it.
Yeah, I've seen that a few times where they forget to remove the Alec logos from the cut and paste legislation that they're sent. And they just walk it onto the floor with the ALEC logo still on it and then try to claim that they wrote it. So, you know, it's ridiculous, but it's also what's actually happening. And again, the more you learn about this stuff, the more vote motivated you are to get out on the streets and to knock doors for a candidate, or in my case, to jump in with both feet and become a candidate.
And I give you credit for doing that. Let me ask you a last question. What's the pitch? What do you want people to do?
What I want people to do is I want them to get involved. All right. As Democrats in particular, we're not going to be as rich in money. And especially at the state legislature level, we're going to get outspent. But we can outwork them. You know, we're rich in people and we're rich in volunteers. I have a fantastic crew of people helping me through this campaign. And we can beat them. We can just outwork them. We can out-knock, we can out-shake, we can out-talk, and we can just get out the ground game. And whatever you do, everyone must vote.
Yes, because we've out-procreated them. There are more of us. We should use that leverage. By all means, register to vote and get out and vote. And even in Ohio, where they want to use 80-weight paper. One of my favorite J. Kenneth Blackwell moments. Anyway, Brett, I wish you the best. I hope you keep knocking on the doors and turn that seat over. You want to check out Brett's website, brettpransky.com. We'll tweet that out so folks will get an opportunity to look at it. Brett, thanks so much. Good talking with you.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Good stuff. Again, brettpransky.com is the website. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
From United Nations headquarters in New York, I'm Luke Vargas with your World in 2 minutes. The World Health Organization says the coming weeks will determine whether a worsening Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of the Congo turns into a regional public health crisis. Dr. Peter Salama is the WHO's Deputy Director General for Emergency Preparedness and Response.
We're on the epidemiological knife edge of this response. The next few weeks will really tell if this outbreak is going to expand to urban areas or if we're going to be able to keep it under control.
Thus far, the WHO has documented 58 Ebola cases and 27 deaths in the DRC. And to keep things under control, they're tracking 600 people that could have come into contact with the virus. This contract tracing was used during a West African Ebola outbreak between 2014 and 2016 that left more than 11,000 people dead. But this current outbreak differs in one key respect, thanks to the existence of an experimental Ebola vaccine now being administered in the field.
This is not mass immunization. This is highly targeted ring vaccination where a confirmed or probable case is identified, and then each and every contact is traced and vaccinated. And then the contacts of those contacts are then traced and vaccinated, forming protective rings around that case.
Though the vaccine is no silver bullet, it's unclear exactly how long it offers protection from infection, and it must be continually stored at sub-zero temperatures as low as negative 112 degrees Fahrenheit, a major challenge as health authorities crisscross the jungles of the DRC. But while the jungles of the Congo offer up geographic hurdles and the country is chronically underdeveloped, Salama says the country's extensive experience battling Ebola on 8 occasions since the 1970s is an asset.
It's hard to recall a situation of an outbreak where a government has responded more quickly and more decisively than in this outbreak.
Luke Vargas, the United Nations.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Arnold sent a message over with the hashtag, Daddy, I want to buy a Republican. they're for sale. They're for sale. You can get them. They're not cheap, though. You can't get them. That's not actually true. They're actually fairly cheap. You look at some of the amounts of money that these congressional campaigns take. A couple thousand, $40,000, $50,000 to push legislation that, benefits, these billionaires in the hundreds of thousands, if not in the millions and billions. It's quite remarkable. I mean, you look at the Koch brothers, they spend, a couple $100 million a year, and they got it all back in this last tax plan. Win, and that winning for them, not so much for us. And look, they spend a lot of money on it. So they have the best democracy our money can buy, because after all, it is our money. We're the ones who created the wealth. And I always love hearing people, no, I'm a self-made man, or, you didn't make anything by yourself. The working people of this country, with the ache of their back and the sweat of their brow and their hands, created that wealth. We've just got a rigged tax system, and we've got a rigged system in this country of that basically screws workers at every turn. And look, they've give them credit where credit is due. They have built these institutions. I mean, the American Legislative Exchange Council, everybody's heard. But the American City and County Exchange, they're just as devastating. They're just as effective in pushing local policy, because they understand how symbiotic local policy and state policy are. And then if they can get the federal and the state and the county and the city and the borough all to be on the same ideological page, wow, double win. And also, it's like, pulling the arm and the one-armed bandit and winning the big prize. For them, the noise in their ears must get really, really annoying, because, the cash register is just blowing out for them. I mean, it's really quite remarkable when you stop and you think about the amount of revenue that they're able to stash in their pockets. I mean, it's scary stuff. And we've got policymakers who are tone deaf to it. The fact that they passed through that tax bill, they rammed that through like thieves in the night. Even though most people I know are like, no, more tax cuts for the wealthy. When are we going to stop this? I mean, my entire life, we've had the tax cut fetish. You would think by now we would be like GE, where the government would be paying us. I mean, honestly, I mean, for as much as I've heard of politicians go, we're going to cut your taxes, I'm paying the same. It's just a different people. So the state cuts my taxes. Okay, my local property taxes go up. The federal government cuts my taxes up. The state raises it. Or they go, oh, we need a higher sales tax. I mean, look, you got to pay for what you need. And we're not even getting what we need. I was watching this show last night on Germany, and it was this little 5-minute little clip, and they were saying Germany's roads are perfect. They don't even have speed limits in a lot of places, and their speed limits are much higher than ours. And the reason that our speed limits aren't higher is because, one, we got crummy drivers because the training's terrible, but two, our infrastructure sucks. You're going to go zipping down the road at 120 miles an hour, hit a pothole, turn sideways, do 15 rolls and flips, and hit 15 other people because we can't figure out how to fill a hole in the ground. How difficult is that? Get a shovel, put some stuff in it. But we can't even do that right, because, We're broke. Scary, scary stuff to me. Anyway, love to hear your thoughts. Quick break. Right back with Sarah Burris from Raw Story.
Controversial, thought-provoking, opinionated. Rick Smith.